Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Werewolf of Rannoch by Ellen Scrismore. It was a chill night in late January. The snow lay thick upon the ground, the wind howled among the trees, and the full moon shone down on a desolate wilderness. Half a mile from the little village of Duvers, a village situated in the very heart and desolation of Rannoch, stood a little unpretentious house tenanted by Dr. Chisholm and his sister. It was a wild, dreary spot in which to live, and the mystery and horrors which had fallen upon the little community were in keeping with the weirdness of the place itself. For some months, Duvers had suffered from an evil visitation, to put it in the words of the wee free Meister. Cattle and sheep had been found dead in their pens, bloody and torn. Horses in their stalls had not escaped. Pigs in their sties, dogs in their kennels, chickens in their runs, all had suffered. And the manner of the kill was always the same. The throat of the victim was lacerated and bleeding, and the bowels torn from the body were left partly devoured. "It's a killer," said the moorland folk. "It's a killer. Keep your cattle under lock and key." For a killer is a dread thing among the shepherds and cotters of the north. By a killer they mean a sheepdog that has gone mad for blood, a dog that can no longer be trusted to look after the sheep, but one that will steal away as soon as darkness falls and will slay the very creatures he is trained to guard. But when children disappeared, and grown men and women, and their bodies were afterwards found torn and bleeding, lacerated with savage tooth marks, the people looked at each other timidly, and kept behind bolted doors at night, and prayed with the minister and the kirk on the Sabbath that the visitation might be lifted from them. And it was the Reverend Evan McIntosh himself who wrote to Sheila Crerar and asked her to come and investigate the mystery that surrounded Duvers, for he had known her since she was a little girl and had heard of her marvelous successes. She had accepted, and Miss Chisholm had offered to put her up, as the manse was only a bachelor establishment. So Sheila arrived at the little Highland cockin, situated in the heart of remote Rannoch Moor, and set to work on perhaps the most gruesome mystery she ever had to solve. The days passed, and she was still unsuccessful. Each morning she chose a new theory upon which to work, and each night had to abandon it as being either impossible or absurd. There was certainly the element of the unreal about the visitation. Crofters averred they saw a shaggy shape with eyes like burning coal slinking about the hillside at the full of the moon, and always, after the creature had been seen, there was a kill. Children were kept indoors at night and came screaming from the ben room, saying they had seen the face of a wolf at the window. The whole countryside was in a ferment of terror, and Sheila felt powerless to cope with it. She followed up clue after clue that proved useless, and all her nerves were on edge. Dr. Chisholm, her host, a cheery soul of 60-odd years, gave her all the help in his power, but he was openly skeptical about her theory that the killer was possibly of a supernatural element. "I'm sure we shall find that it is simply some mad dog loose on the country, Miss Gerard. What else can it be?" "Have you never heard of werewolves, doctor?" she asked quietly. "Yes," he replied, "but I don't think I am quite sure in my own mind as to what they are supposed to be." "They are men with dual personalities, doctor, who have the power to change themselves into the form of a wolf or some other carnivorous animal." "My dear Miss Gerard," smiled the doctor genially and ran his hand through his snowy hair. "Oh, I believe in it, doctor. It is another form of the Jekyll and Hyde theory. That's all, only a much worse form. The astral spirit leaves the body in a sleeping condition while it assumes an animal shape itself. Thus free, it roams around the world at will and lengthens its existence by drinking fresh, warm blood drawn from a new kill." "Surely that is quite a medieval superstition, Miss Carrar," protested the doctor again. "We're in the prosaic 20th century, and—" But Sheila refused to answer. She had been in touch with the unreal too often to doubt. She knew the power of the spirits from the other world, the tangibility of the elemental. She had come across the very element, the very essence of witchcraft. Nothing was impossible. And that night, as she stood at the garden gate after dinner and enjoyed the glory of a white earth under a full moon, she caught sight of a shadowy gray shape creeping among the trees. It was her first glimpse of the killer. Without a thought of fear, she bounded after it. Hatless, coatless, breathless, she followed it. It turned its head. Its eyes gleamed viciously, and it snarled angrily. Sheila pulled a branch of white thorn, a protection against witchcraft, and held it high above her head. The wolf leapt at her, but as it touched the tree, it whined, slunk around a corner, and when Sheila moved a second later, it had vanished from sight. There was no place in which it could hide, yet it had gone completely, and the only living thing in sight was a man who was walking quickly into the distance. She hurried after him, but the space between them never seemed to lessen. His walk, his figure, his manner seemed familiar to her, but there suddenly came a flash, and when she opened her eyes, he too was gone. She walked back slowly and ran into Dr. Chisholm. "I've proved my theory," she said with quiet concentration. "The visitant is a werewolf. I have seen it tonight, and I must now set to work to discover who it is that is the menace to this little place. I believe some men have no knowledge that they possess this power, and while their astral spirit is absent, they are asleep and unconscious of their evil doings. This werewolf is different. I'm convinced he knows his own powers." "Why? What makes you think that?" "Because just now he appeared as a wolf. A second later the animal had gone, but a man had taken his place. I tried to reach the man. At first I didn't realize that the change had taken place, but when I drew near he used his magical powers, blinded me with a light for a moment, and when I could see he too had vanished." "Have you any idea who this man is?" "Not the slightest at present. Although he seemed familiar to me, I find I am unable to place him, but I shall work hard to discover him, and then..." She left the sentence unfinished, and the kindly doctor tucked his arms through hers and led the way back to his house. But although Sheila saw the ominous gray shape many times, she was never able to track it to its lair. "Will you watch with me tonight, doctor?" she asked one day. "I want to try and discover the direction from which the werewolf comes. Let us hide in the bushes by the churchyard. We shall be safe there on consecrated ground." So they waited that night at the edge of the little graveyard, a spot eerie and forlorn. "Get behind the tombstone," said the doctor genially, "and I'll wait here." "But I can't see you, doctor." "Never mind, I can see you." So they waited. The moon was hidden beneath heavy clouds. The wind was piercing and heavy flakes of snow cut Sheila's face and made it smart. Suddenly, as the clock in the church tower boomed 12, there came the sound of ghostly laughter, laughter that seemed to come from the regions of the damned. Sheila felt her blood run cold, and as she watched, she heard the baying of hounds in the distance, and knew them to be the ghostly hounds of the wicked dead. Nearer they drew, and nearer. Sheila watched their approach, counted them mechanically. 5, 6, 7, 8. And they strained at a leash that was held taut by their invisible master. And even as they passed her, Sheila heard the crack of a whip and saw the quiver of the flesh that was flayed. Yet of the whip itself, there was nothing to be seen. As they passed, leaving a luminous trail behind them, she saw the gray, hulking shapes speed swiftly by. There was the snapping of hungry jaws, a cry of pain, and the ghostly pack only numbered 7. They had passed, and all was still and quiet. "Doctor, doctor, don't say now that you don't believe," said Sheila. "Doctor, doctor," she cried again. "Dr. Chisholm, are you there?" And a frightened note crept into her voice. But the genial doctor answered, his voice grave and low, "Forgive me, Miss Carrar. I scarcely realized you were speaking. I was carried away by the scene." Sheila left her hiding place and crossed to him. He was rising from the shelter of a large wind bush, and the girl cried out in dismay. "Oh, doctor, thank God you're safe. Why, what is the matter, Miss Carrar? Do you realize... you have not been on consecrated ground at all. You were on the path that separates the graveyard from the flower garden that surrounds it." He gave a little wry smile. "Then it was your presence that no doubt saved me from harm, my dear." Then one day Sheila saw the werewolf lurking in the meadow near the Chisholm's byre. With a protecting white thorn spray, she tracked it, but it disappeared behind the building itself, and as she turned the corner, she came face to face with Dr. Chisholm's partner. They passed with a curt good night, and Sheila thought no more about the incident. A week later it was, however, brought back to her mind. She was waiting again in the churchyard, but this time alone. Midnight boomed out, and the killer passed. But even as he vanished from sight, the doctor's partner appeared from the copse at the side of the road. This time she passed him without speaking. For the moment her eyes lighted upon him, a wild possibility suggested itself to her mind, and she felt at last that she had a clue, that at last she was on the right track. When she had first met Dr. Chisholm's partner, she had taken a dislike to him. He was a Dane, Olaf Selmak by name, a dark, taciturn man of late middle life. She felt sorry he was an inmate of Knocknadweed, as the Chisholm's house was called. She never spoke to him more than courtesy demanded of her. She read craft in his expression, cruelty in his tight, thin lips, and shivered at the touch of his damp, flaccid hand. And now, while she hoped the denouement was not far off, the killer was always abroad when the moon was full, and tonight she would try and track the malefactor to its lair. "Well," said Dr. Chisholm, genially, as she said good night, "you have not discovered the identity of our unpleasant visitor yet?" "Not yet, but I think I am at last on his track." The old man's eyes twinkled, and he gave an exaggerated little shudder. "Oh, you modern women, you dabble in science and medicine. You dabble in politics and law, and now you dabble in the occult. What else is there left for mere man?" "Well, doctor, you'll be glad if this mysterious horror is satisfactorily cleared up, won't you?" "Of course I shall, my dear young lady. And so will Mary." He nodded affectionately at his sister. "Why, Mary scarcely ever sleeps a wink at night, now do you?" Miss Chisholm, a delicate spinster many years her brother's junior, looked up flutteringly. "Indeed, Miss Carrar, I have not. If it were not for Dr. Silmack's kindness to me, his cheery presence, and the wonderful tonic he has made up for me for nerves, I'm sure I should have had a breakdown long ago. The suspense is terrible, not to know from one minute to the next whether the killer will make his visitation here." Sheila looked grave. "You like Dr. Silmack, don't you, Miss Chisholm?" The little lady flushed. "It is quite a secret. My brother, of course, knows. But if Dr. Silmack is successful in a big experiment he is making, we are to be married." Sheila was unable to look into the candid eyes of the little young old lady. I hope he will be successful," she murmured. And then not only did she look surprised herself by bending over the spinster and kissing her on the forehead, saying, "But above all, I hope you will be happy." When she reached her room, she muttered angrily to herself, "If I am right in my conjectures, I shall bring unhappiness on that poor little soul who trusts him. Yet, better one heart broken than distress and desolation on many." It was a bitterly cold night, and she wrapped herself up very warmly, put on snowshoes, and pulled a large woolen cap close about her ears. She loaded a little automatic revolver and carefully opened a French window that led from her room to the outside stair, so prevalent in Scottish houses. Quickly she descended it and crept into the shadow of a holly bush and remained waiting, waiting. It was an eerie night. The moon was brilliant, but the huge rings around it foretold stormy weather. The wind moaned and whistled, and Sheila drew her cloak close around her. She looked at her watch and saw that it wanted but a few seconds to midnight when she suddenly stiffened and her nostrils quivered. She had caught the scent of her prey. There was a crunch, crunch, on the frozen snow, and a great gray breeze slunk around the corner of the house. His nose was high in the air, and his red eyes gleamed banefully. The foam dropped from his slobbering jowl, and the steam rose from his heated body. She raised her revolver, and as the beast seemed to scent danger, for with a whimper of fear it slunk into the shadows and vanished from sight. Quickly Sheila followed the direction it had taken. Among the trees she saw a gray shape flitting. It was the malevolent beast she knew to be responsible for the killings. Night after night she had waited for it, tracked it among the peat hags and morasses of the moor, had it followed along the banks of lochs and peaty tarns, across heathery hummocks and granite boulders, but always the uncanny brute had evaded her. But now she had seen it come from the shadows of Knocknadweed, and she felt that the doctor's house was indeed the lair of the werewolf, a thing loathsome, treacherous, vile. And even as she sped after it, She shook with anger at the thought of the gentle spinster who had given her heart to Olaf Silmak, the wolfman. She had no doubts now. She had been suspicious of him from the first. But she now had to prove that he and the killer were one. As she crossed the dreary wasteland, she heard a choking cry of pain, a cry that was hideous in the silence of the night. Still on she went, at last came on the body of a stag. It was a beautiful creature that had cried out in its death agony. Its throat was completely gone, its body ripped open, and its entrails partly devoured. Drops of crimson stained the whiteness of the snow, and Sheila followed the bloody track. On it went across the uneven moorland, and at last came to a sudden stop, and Sheila saw the marks on the snow where the brute had wiped its jaw after its ghoulish meal. The girl found she had journeyed to the edge of the moor. The spot was unfamiliar to her. A rugged mountain rose precipitously from the side of a melancholy loch. Her quest was done for the night. She could trail the beast no further, and she turned back to Naknarweid. And even as she came in sight of the house, she caught a glimpse of a hulking gray form crossing the front lawn. It seemed unconscious of the watchful eye upon it, and stealthily crept beneath the shelter of a half-opened lobby window. For a second or two it remained quiet, and then even the girl watched it. It disappeared, and a moment later she saw the window shut and heard it latched from the inside. Next day, as soon as breakfast was over, she retraced her steps of the previous night. The body of the stag was still in the same place, and the bloodstains, faint and blurred, still directed her. At the edge of the loch, she hesitated and wondered which way to turn. A quarter way up the mountain side, a huge lichen-covered boulder jutted out. At its base grew thick bushes of stunted holly, and Sheila, practiced eye, told her that some massive body had crept hastily beneath the shelter of the low branches. She climbed swiftly up to it and peered beneath. There was an opening at the foot of the rock, and fearless as ever, she crept into the passageway. The way proved to be very narrow, and she ran, perhaps 30 feet down, into a large cavern. As Sheila entered, she gave a cry of excited pleasure. She had found the wolfman's lair. The place was full of strange devices and mechanical appliances, the use of which she did not know. High up on the rocky wall was a tiny ledge. Quickly she tried to reach it. It was an arduous task, but she was sure-footed. The rocky wall gave her foothold, and she reached it safely. It was in reality the mouth of a tiny cave, and she could stay in there for safety and watch all unseen anyone who might be down below. It commanded a perfect view of the whole cavern. She hurried home and rested, preparing for her nocturnal adventure, but she was not destined to go out that night. A sudden storm came on, the rain came down in torrents, and she knew it would be a physical impossibility to walk the 5 miles alone. She went to bed early, however, and quivered with indignation as she saw Dr. Silmak bending tenderly over the gentle spinster who looked with such trust into his eyes. He was a werewolf, a man whose astral spirit took on the form of a wolf and prowled at night in search of prey, a man who left his body in his chamber while his real self gorged on cannibalistic feast. It was terrible, horrible, abhorrent. She was restless in her sleep. Her dreams were uneasy, and she tossed from side to side in the large canopied bed. Suddenly she realized that she was awake and listened. There was a soft pad-padding outside her door, and she heard the snuffling of an animal, followed by a tiny whimper. Now, there were no animals at Naknarweid, neither cat nor dog nor bird. The house possessed no pets. She lit her candle and looked around quickly, and gave a sigh of relief as she saw the branch of a white thorn by her side. She caught it up in her hand and opened her door. There was nothing outside. She felt a little mystified. She expected an encounter with a ghostly creature itself, and was a little disappointed. She shut her door and listened. Again she heard the whimper. This time she crept behind the door and waited. Slowly, the door opened, yet neither handle turned nor lock clicked. It seemed to glide through rather than open, and through the crack in the hinges she saw the wolf outside. There was no mistaking it. Its little red eyes gleamed with hatred, and its tongue lolled out of its mouth hungrily. It entered her bedchamber. Round and round it stalked, and she, ever watchful, held the white thorn high above her head. It was a mighty duel of wits and strength. The great gray shape crouched at her feet. Its breath was fetid and violent, and its coat gave forth a sulphurous vapor. Its murderous little eyes seemed to laugh as it saw the effort Sheila had to make to keep her arms above her head. How long they faced each other she never knew. She felt at any moment she must let her arms drop, for very weariness. The stench of the creature was unbearable. The fumes from its body choked and nauseated her. She saw her little revolver on her dressing table, but was unable to reach it. Her eyes grew dim, her head ached. Then suddenly the wolf was gone, and a pure white kitten clawed at her skirt and mewed piteously. Its foot was hurt, and in the prettiest way imaginable it lifted up its little paw. For a moment only, she hesitated. Then, with a swift movement, she slashed viciously at the pretty little creature with her weapon of white thorn, and the same instant reached to her revolver. When she looked again, there was no pretty white kitten, but a hideous gray creature that whined savagely and licked the blood that oozed from a jagged wound across its body. That moment, Sheila fired, and with a cry, the wolf leapt out of the door, and she realized she had missed it. But had she, after all? Dr. Silmack appeared at the door, and there was blood upon his hand. "What is the matter, Miss Carrar? I heard a noise, and came to see what it was. At that minute, you must have fired, for see, the bullet just grazed my little finger." Sheila gazed at him in horror. Then she had touched the gray shape after all. She thought she had missed, but was there no such thing as repercussion? If she wounded the wolf, would not the man also suffer? If she killed the wolf, would not the man die in like manner? Although she had leveled a revolver at the wolf, Olaf Selmak had received the discharge. He was indeed curious, but she did not mean to show her hand yet. "Pray accept my apologies," he said sweetly. "I thought I saw a burglar. I woke from a bad dream. I do hope I have not hurt you much." "Nothing to worry about, Miss Garrard. Go back to sleep, and sleep better. Good night, good night." But Sheila did not intend delaying further, and directly after dinner, the next night, she slipped out of her room and started on her walk to the Wolfman's cave. She had plenty of time. It was still before 9. She reached the place in safety, climbed the rocky wall, and waited. It was very dreary in that place of fear. She wished she had told Dr. Chisholm of her discovery, and invited him to accompany her. Time dragged. She must have fallen asleep, for suddenly she realized the place was lighted by huge torches that were fitted in brackets on the wall. In the center of the cavern, a brazier burned its flames blue and red. A hooded man in a red gown, covered in strange hieroglyphs, stood over it, muttering in a monotone as he sprinkled the powder on the glowing coals that caused the flames to shoot up around its feet, assuming the colors of the rainbow. A faint cry came from a darkened corner, and Sheila gazed in horror as she saw the magician stoop down and lift up in his arm a tiny naked child of perhaps 2 years. The plump little body squirmed and struggled with fear, but the man held it deftly while he anointed it with oils and sweet-smelling spices. Suddenly he held a knife aloft, and Sheila buried her face in her hands. There was an agonizing cry, a cry that ended with a muffled, choking moan and silence. The girl felt too sick to watch, but the scene had its fascination as well as its horror, and tightly clasped in her hand was her loaded revolver. She would make no mistake tonight, but the wizard had not yet finished his revels. He dragged a stool in front of the brazier, and on it he placed 2 quaint figures. Subconsciously, Sheila realized they were familiar. She peered cautiously down from her hiding place and realized that one was dressed like Miss Chisholm, while the other was wrapped round in a black hood, the exact counterpart of the one she was wearing at the moment. The figure below raised the effigy of Miss Chisholm, and in a low voice called on Satan the Mighty, and Sheila knew she was looking at a Corp Creed ceremony. She did not know that the practice still existed, the cult of fashioning a body in clay, and by aid of ghastly spells and prayers to the devil, working harm through its medium upon the person it represented. The sorcerer held the little clay figure in one hand, and with a long pincer-shaped instrument twisted off the right hand from the wrist, and as he did so a cry of pain came from the effigy, and a second later Sheila heard Miss Chisholm's voice cry out, "It hurts! It hurts!" Then the image was flung contemptuously aside, and the man picked up the one dressed in the likeness of Sheila. He lifted the Corp Creed in his hand, and with a muffled word of hatred bent over it for a moment before he plunged the entire left arm into the flame. And as the limb was shriveled up by the furnace, it uttered a wail of agony. But Sheila had turned white and deadly faint, and she realized she was suffering the pain of burns. She hesitated no longer and fired twice in a quick succession at the monster below. A piercing shriek broke the stillness of the night, and the man below had vanished, but Sheila saw a gray shape lift up its muzzle in the air and howl dismally, and even as it did so, it too disappeared from her ken. Sheila, trembling and terror-stricken, crept home in the gray morning. Her arm was painful, but she had bound it up with strips torn from her petticoat, In the dim light, she saw great blisters had risen from the inflamed flesh. She was worn out and tired and hoped to creep into her room unseen, but she found the house full of excitement and trouble. Miss Chisholm was in the dining room, weeping convulsively. Dr. Olive Silmack was bending over her and soothing her. "Why? Whatever is the matter?" asked Sheila. My brother," sobbed the woman. He is dead." "What?" And as she spoke, she noticed Miss Chisholm's right hand was bandaged. "Shot twice through the heart, Miss Serrar. I heard the sound of a revolver fired twice, in quick succession, and when I rushed into Dr. Chisholm's room, he was quite dead." Sheila looked full into Olaf Silmack's eyes and read the truth there. "May I see him?" she asked quietly. It was Dr. Silmack himself who led her into the darkened death chamber. The face of Robert Chisholm had lost its benignity, its contour. The lips were drawn back and revealed sharp fangs, fangs that scarcely seemed to belong to a human creature. "There will be no more killings now, Miss Carrar," said Olaf Silmack softly. "You knew?" breathed Sheila. The man nodded. "I suspected it some time ago. I've been watching. Forgive me. Oh, forgive me," cried the girl. But Olaf Silmack never knew what she meant. The Eyes of Doom by Ella M. Scrismore. Sheila Carrar felt very lonely as she sat in her tiny sitting room in her dreary lodgings. She was tired, too, mentally as well as physically, and she tried to forget the misery of the past 6 months. An orphan, she had been brought up by an uncle who idolized her. For 22 years she had lived in happiness in their home in the Highlands. She could visualize it now, a smallish house for a laird, built in the true Scottish baronial style with turreted roof and pepper-box corners and a tiny courtyard. Ken Craig was built on the top of a high eminence overlooking Loch Lubnaig, and it had been one of her chief delights to sit among the heather and watch the rippling waters of the lake beneath. To her left was Ben Letty, and she reveled in his rugged beauty. He stood for strength and chivalry in her young mind, and she always thought of him as a rough but courteous Bruce, with shaggy locks and tartan kilts flying in the wind. It was only a girlish fancy, but to her, the Ben was a living personality, nature's gentleman, a Highland chief. For 22 years she had bid him good morning and waved him good night. For 22 years she had wandered among the heather, bathed in the loch, and driven into Callander once a week to do her shopping. And now she wondered why this sorrow should have come to her. 6 months ago she had been out in the woods gathering rowan berries. She had gone home gay and bright, but there was no welcoming figure of Uncle John waiting at the door for her. She went into a study, and oh, the horror of it. He was sitting at his desk, his eyes open wide, his mouth twisted sideways, his hands cold. He did not answer her call. She knew he was dead. Heart failure, the doctor said, and Sheila felt that the light had gone out of her world. The funeral over, she had gone into the library with Mr. MacArthur, her uncle's attorney. At first, Sheila did not understand what Mr. MacArthur was trying to tell her. She couldn't realize that she had been left penniless, with only a heavily mortgaged estate as a legacy. Mr. MacArthur advised her to sell Ken Craig, pay off the mortgage, and with what little remained, overfit herself to take her place among the workers of the great world. But Sheila refused to sell her home. Every stone was precious to her. Every corner was a dear living friend. At last she agreed to let it on a 5-year lease to a rich American widow. "What do you intend doing now?" he asked. "I shall have about 100 pounds. I shall go to London and try and get something to do there." She was obstinate. She procured cheap rooms in London, in a row derisively called Air Street. Her 100 pounds did not go far. In vain she tried for work in the great metropolis. No one wanted her. Depressed and silent, she sat in her little room and wondered what would happen when her scanty money gave out. She was a petite maid with nut-brown hair and gray eyes that looked all too trustingly at a cruel and heartless world. She had no money to spend on amusements, and as she walked the streets of the great city, she saw visions of the long ago. She wandered in London's inn and saw the passing of sedan chairs, watched gallants with silken and jeweled sword bend low before their lady loves. She sought out old London and lived alone in the 17th century. Always psychic, Her gift seemed troubled in her sorrow and loneliness, and her only friends now were the dim ghosts of the past. She was sitting in the gardens of Lincoln's Inn one day, when she suddenly became aware of a quaint figure beside her, a wizened man of perhaps 60 years, in a dark claret-colored suit, with a black three-cornered hat upon his knee. And as she looked, he took a pinch of snuff from a beautifully enameled box and applied it to his nostrils, his little finger delicately poised like a bird on the wing. "You are sad and lonely, little lady," he said suddenly. "Why not help those that are sad and lonely, too? You have a gift, a most wonderful gift of sight. Use that sight for your own benefit and the benefit of mankind. I promise you, you will not fail." "But how?" she began. But the quaint little figure had gone, and there was only a fat old woman with an untidy dress and a rusty black bonnet, watching her curiously from the further corner of the seat. Sheila felt dazed. She rose and looked around. No, she was still in the bustling world of taxis and motor buses. The picturesque past had vanished. She smiled a little and went home, but her brain was working hard. She slept well that night, and when morning came, her mind was made up. For the next 3 days, an advertisement appeared in the agony column of the Times. "Lady of gentle birth, Scottish, young, penniless, possessing strong psychic powers, will devote her services to the solving of uncanny mysteries or the laying of ghosts. Offer quite genuine. Reply with particulars and remuneration offer. To S.C. care of Mrs. Baker, 14B Air Street, Regent's Park, London." And now she was waiting, waiting. 2 days passed since her advertisement first appeared. A double knock sounded, the postman. A footstep sounded outside, and Mrs. Barker appeared. "A registered lady for you, my dear," she remarked cheerily. "I'll be bringing your supper in half a tick. See, it's a bloater tonight, ain't it? A poor man's steak, I calls it." And Sheila shuddered slightly. The well-meant vulgarity repelled her. The stench of cooking fish nauseated her. She felt nervy, restless, ill. The Highlands were calling her. She longed to feel the springing heather under her feet, to drink in the strong air. It was the call of the hills. She looked at the thick-crusted envelope curiously. Certainly an answer to advertisement, for it was addressed to her initials, S.C. Slowly she read it, and a flush of excitement crept into her cheeks. Dunfermline Loch Long. If S.C.'s offer is really genuine, will she accept the enclosed £10 on account for immediate expenses, and wire Lady Kildrummy that she is prepared to try to solve and perhaps lay forever the very unpleasant mystery known as the Kildrummy Weird. If S.C. states the time she will arrive at Arrowrock Station, Lady Kildrummy will see that there is a car sent to meet her. Sheila's eyes glowed. Arrowcar, Scotland. Her luck had turned at last. She was going back to her beloved Highlands. But would she succeed in her undertaking? Then she remembered the little old man in Lincoln's Inn. "You will not fail," he had said. Of course, she had heard of the Kildrummy Weird. Who had not? Was it not as much speculated upon as the hidden mystery of Glamis? Was it not even as mysterious? What was the story? Did not some great calamity happen when the weird appeared? Next day she wired Lady Kildrummy that she would come at once, and she caught the night train to Glasgow, where she changed for the West Highland Line. At Arrowcar Station, or which Ben Lomond towered, she looked round eagerly. A tall man in the late 30s came towards her, a handsome man, rugged, strong, in a kilt of the Cameron tartan, his mother's clan. "Miss Carrar," he asked, raising his bonnet. "I am Stavordale Hartland. My aunt, Lady Kildrummy, asked me to meet you." His voice was pleasantly tuneful, and the wholesome admiration in his eyes could do naught but please her. Instantly she compared him to rugged Ben Letty, and had the man at her side but known, it was the greatest compliment she could have paid him. Dunfermline was situated in Argyllshire, side of the Loch Long, nestling under the great shoulder of the cobbler himself. Lady Kildrummy met with outstretched hands. "How good of you to come, my dear. Are you by any chance related to Carrar of Kencraig?" "He was my uncle." "Then you are doubly welcome, for Kencraig was my late husband's greatest friend. Now, Stavordale, you can leave Miss Carrar and me to have tea together." It was not until they had finished their tea that her hostess commenced her story. "My dear, I am in great trouble," she said by way of starting. "Your advertisement interested me, and I wondered if you could lay forever the weird that haunts this place. Up to now, the story has been kept absurdly secret. I think none of us wanted to believe in it. Since the time of Conac the Strong, in the latter part of the 16th century, Kildrummy has been cursed by this weird. Every 23 years, some terrible calamity has occurred in the family, preceded for about 6 months by the Eyes. The Eyes? Yes, the Eyes of Doom, they are called. The Kildrummy weird takes a form of eyes that appear and disappear and are mainly seen in the West Wing. In recent years, calamity has fallen on this house after the eyes have been seen. In 1874, the year I was married, my husband's two elder brothers died, each by his own hand. One was found drowned in the loch, the other was shot on the summit of the cobbler yonder. At both inquests, the verdict was accident death. But we all knew better. It was the eyes that had driven them mad. My husband became heir to the title, and in 1897, my eldest son poisoned himself. Again, it was put down to an accident. He was dabbling in photography, and it was supposed that he took some cyanide by mistake for his medicine. But it was no accident. 23 years had passed, and he had seen the eyes. This is 1920, Miss Carrar, and it is 23 years since dear Mid died. And I am afraid. My son Duncan, the only one left to me, is now 26 years old. Lately he has complained of being kept awake by night by curious creakings. He has seen strange lights, and oh, he is changed. I can't explain what I mean. You will see for yourself. He is all nerves. I am convinced he has seen the eyes of doom. Will you try and solve the mystery for me, Miss Carrar? What the cause is, I don't know, but the hideous waiting for some tragedy to fall is terrible. I'll do my best, Lady Kildrummy. I can promise you no more. That evening Sheila met Duncan Kildrummy. Although young, he was a distinguished soldier, had won the DSO and been mentioned several times in dispatches, and had the reputation among his friends of being a regular daredevil. But Sheila had a shock when she saw him. His hands were restless, the flesh under his eyes was puffy and dark, and if he was spoken to suddenly, his whole body would respond with nervous twitchings. "Lady Kildrummy," she said after dinner, "will you put your son into another room to sleep and leave his empty for me to examine? I can see he's in a state of great mental distress. Can't you get him to go away for a change?" "It's no use, Miss Carrar. I have begged him to go away, but nothing will induce him to leave." That night, Sheila changed into a dark rest gown, and when everyone had retired to bed, she prowled up and down the long corridors, armed only with a tiny flash lamp. She unlocked the chapel door and went inside. Suddenly, she felt an icy blast that seemed to pierce through her, and the heavy door closed silently behind her. She felt startled and tried to open it, but the catch was down on the other side. She was locked in. The sudden gust of wind was not repeated, yet she found she was shivering with cold from head to foot. Always venturesome, the thought never entered her head to find a way of rousing the household. If she was unable to get out, then she would stay in the chapel till day came. She sat down in one of the old-fashioned pews and looked about her. The moon was conveniently bright, and she could distinguish objects quite clearly by its light. As she sat, she became aware that someone was looking at her, and she turned sharply round. A pair of eyes was gazing at her, eyes so mournful, so full of grief that Sheila felt her own fill with tears of sympathy. And as she met the piteous gaze, she became suddenly conscious of the fact that the eyes were not framed by a face. She rose with a startled exclamation of horror and turned away, but to her right another pair of eyes appeared, eyes this time that were mad with hate, eyes so filled with loathing and malevolence that Sheila backed away from them in fear. But now the whole chapel seemed filled with the ghastly sight, eyes with expression, eyes without, eyes kind, eyes cruel, eyes imbecile, eyes fanatical, eyes with every expression in them that man could conceive. Sheila put out her hands to beat the swelling mass away, but even as her arms were extended in front of her, they were caught in a ghostly vice, and she was dragged to the vestry door. She was drawn by unseen hands, hands that possessed an unseen body. All that she could see of her captor was two eyes, eyes that shone in the moonlight, and that looked at her with cruel menace. The vestry door swung silently open, and she was dragged through, followed by the eyes. She had no time to look round, for the door that communicated with the west wing, which was always doubly locked and barred, now stood open wide, and through it Sheila was taken. The west wing was partly a ruin, and the wind whistled through a glassless window and roofless halls. Then the grip of iron relaxed, and she found she was in a small turret, and round her were 23 pairs of eyes, all baleful and cruel except one, and that one pair seemed as if they might belong to a wounded deer, so plaintive were they, so mournful and sad. Sheila moved towards the door, but the eyes surrounded her. She tried to dodge them, tried to get away from them, but it was impossible. She was keenly guarded, as if by living bodies. Then she grew really frightened, terrified. Her brain seemed to go numb. Her teeth chattered, and she cried out aloud in her agony of dread. But the eyes grew fiercer and more cruel. They seemed to menace her. With a cry, she threw herself at the bodiless terror, and all became dark. For a while she remembered nothing. Then she was conscious that she was being carried down long corridors and up steep stairs. There was a sound of a click, and a voice said, "Do you want anything, Miss Carrar? I heard you call out, so I came across to you." It was Lady Kildrummy. "I'm thirsty," cried Sheila. "And oh, please, Lady Kildrummy, will you put the light on?" But Lady Kildrummy stared in amazement, for he had switched on the electric light as she entered the room. She bent over the girl. Her eyes were open wide, but they met her gaze with a cold stare. The sight had gone. My dear, she breathed, "what has happened? I hardly know. I was in the chapel. Oh, and do please put on the light. It is so dark here." Tenderly, the elder woman put her arms about the girl. "Tell me first what is the matter," she said gently. "The dark is so peaceful, and I am here with you." Incoherently, Sheila spoke. "I was in the chapel. Through the turret room, there were 23 eyes." The girl's voice trailed off. She sensed to be in a stupor, but her eyes were still wide open, and Lady Kildrummy rang a bell. "Tell Dr. Graham to come here at once," she said to the startled maid. "Miss Carrar is ill." The genial doctor, guest in the house, came hurriedly and examined the girl. "She's had a shock," he said. Her eyes, cried Lady Kildrummy distractedly. "My God, blind. But she was all right at dinner," said the doctor. That night, a watchful vigil was kept over Sheila, and when the sun rose, she awoke from her torpor and looked at Lady Kildrummy in amazement. "What is the matter?" she asked curiously. "Why are you here?" And her hostess realized that she had regained the power of sight. When the doctor saw her, he stared at her in amazement. "My dear young lady, why, I bless my soul, there's nothing wrong with her." Sheila told Lady Kildrummy of her experience in the night, but her hostess smiled. "You have certainly described the turret room, Miss Carrar, but you couldn't have got into it last night, as I hold the key." "But I did," protested Sheila. "The door was wide open." "Well, we will go and look at it as soon as you're up, but I assure you, it'd be quite impossible for anyone to open the door without my key." "Now," said Lady Kildrummy later, "you see this door is twice bolted and twice locked." The bolts were stiff, and the key turned with great difficulty, but the nail-studded door swung open at last. Sheila gave a little cry of triumph. The floor, thickly coated with the dust of ages, was marked by freshly made footprints, footprints of long pointed boots that crossed and recrossed each other, and among the old-fashioned prints were made by little light modern shoe. Sheila took hers off and bent down to the mark nearest the door. It fit exactly. "I was here last night," she whispered hysterically, but Lady Kildrummy was almost speechless and terror shone in her eyes. "The eyes of doom," she muttered hoarsely. "God help us, for our troubles are beginning." That night, as Sheila was preparing for bed again, the melancholy eyes appeared. She looked at them fearfully. It was an awe-inspiring sight to watch those expressive eyes move about, propelled by an unseen force. They seemed to float in the air, and she knew their power of locomotion rested in the bodies that were hidden from her sight. And even as she waited, the other eyes manifested themselves. She tried to resist, but the ghostly hands were too strong. And again she was taken to the turret room. A circle of eyes was around her, eyes on a level with her own, but only space above them and space below. But they seemed less malignant, less cruel, though terrifying nevertheless. They seemed to be trying to tell her something, but she was unable to read their message. She was nervous, she was on the defensive, and unconsciously she rendered herself out of tune with the weird. She was not in a fit psychic state to understand them. She was in too material a condition. The eyes seemed to realize this, and they grew menacing, again fretful, impatient. Again there came to the girl a space of forgetfulness, And when she awoke to reality, she was back in her room and she realized she was blind. She moved uncertainly about the room. Everything seemed unfamiliar to her, unreal. Her eyes hurt her. They seemed inflamed. They were sore. All night long, the pain was unbearable, and she sat in a chair, helpless and miserable. But as the dawn came, so a veil seemed to be lifted from her eyes, and she could see once more. It was a blindness that came with the darkness and went with morning light. During the day, Sheila was trying to get into communication with the astral world. She was trying to fit herself to see even deeper into the mystery of the unknown. It was her first trial alone, and she was gradually becoming fitted for the task she had set herself. Daily, Duncan Keldromi grew more silent, more morose, more taciturn. The Keldromi weird was trying to claim him as its victim, and he realized it and knew he was too weak to hold out against it for long. Soon, he too would die, and die accidentally, as so many members of his family had done. The eyes grew more venturesome. One night, a pair hovered over the dinner table and gazed at Duncan intently. All saw them, and as Lady Keldromi screamed in terror, they disappeared. But Duncan rose and stumbled blindly out of the room. Stavordale went quickly after him and found his cousin staring at the cold waters of the loch. He was staring, staring, and there was a look of madness in his eyes. The next night, several pairs circled round him. He tried to beat them off, and they seemed always just out of his reach, and their expression mocked him. Stavordale Hartland attached himself to Sheila, and she found his strong personality a great help to her in the nerve-wracking time she was going through. Night after night, when the eyes claimed her, she found she was a helpless entity in their grasp, and in the turret room they supplicated, entreated, menaced her, and still she was unable to read their meaning. And daily the eyes seemed to appear more often. They followed Duncan from room to room. They drove him out of the house, and he would disappear for hours at a time, and his mother's heart would ache with apprehension. One night Sheila resolved not to go to bed, and Lady Keldromi and Stavordale agreed to sit up all night with her in the library, for Sheila had come to dread the period of blindness that was forced upon her in so mysterious a way, and she wondered if in company she would be strong enough to resist the ghostly hands. First one pair of eyes appeared, and then another, until all 23 pairs surrounded the trio. As if turned to stone, Lady Keldromi and Stavordale Hartland watched Sheila forcibly dragged out of the room. They could neither move nor speak, and when Sheila returned to them, she found that three helpless people would have to stay in the library until dawn, for this time they were all blind. Next night, Sheila and Stavordale were standing together watching Duncan walking restlessly up and down the terrace. "Don't you think you had better give all this up, little girl?" said Stavordale Hartland, and his voice held a tender, caressing note. "I can't," she said passionately. "Look at him. He is all his mother has. Can't you see the eyes are driving him mad? The weird will claim another victim unless I can prevent it." And even as she spoke, the evil eyes appeared, phosphorescent in the darkness, and with a wild shriek, Duncan Keldromi fled into the blackness of the night. Until the morning, he roamed the country at large, and when he appeared at breakfast, he was haggard and worn, and the most inexperienced eye could tell that he was really ill. Sheila alone seemed to have a soothing effect upon him, and when late in the day Dr. Graham administered a sleeping draught, he suggested that Sheila should sit by his bedside until it took effect. Lady Keldromi left her for a moment. Immediately Sheila was conscious that the eyes were watching her. Before she realized it, she was in the turret room, and she found she was numb from head to foot. She was powerless to move. As she watched, the eyes suddenly materialized into men. Gradually their bodies appeared until 22 men in doublet and hose stood before her. Their garments were of silk and velvet, rich, costly, gay. And a 23rd of that ghostly company was a girl, almost a child of not more than 15 years. Her hair was unbound and her face distorted with grief, and she clung piteously to a black-bearded man of middle age. A ghostly play began, and all the while Sheila watched with increasing horror. Others appeared on the scene, men in kilt and plaid, with dirks drawn, dirks red with blood. Roughly, the girl was torn from the arms of her father and bound with hempen ropes. The scenes that followed were hideous to behold, and Sheila knew there was a power of work that compelled her to watch. The captive girl writhed and tore at her bonds, but all to no purpose. They were too cunningly tied. Not a word was said aloud, but the agonized expressions, the black terror, spoke louder than words. Two ghostly figures in black carried in a red-hot brazier, The coal burned and seemed to splutter, yet made no sound. Two long irons were placed in the glowing coal. The prisoners made a desperate effort to overpower their captors. For a few moments, the whole place was in confusion, but gradually their efforts were subdued, and one by one they were dragged to the fire, one by one. The red, hot iron was plunged into their eyes. One by one, they were blinded and flung aside to die. Sheila watched 22 men done to death in this awful way. She watched their agonies of pain, their writhings, their torments, and the scene was all the more horribly because of the deathly silence that accompanied it. There was but one more victim, the girl. Roughly, she was dragged to the brazier, but a merciful providence intervened. She stumbled and fell, and when a man roughly turned her over with his foot, he found the gentle spirit had fled. The assassins looked around the room at the dead, and even as they did so, the scene changed, and Sheila found she was out in the Chestnut Avenue, standing before the giant tree, the pride of Dunferry. The rain poured down in torrents. The wind blew hard. Her dress clung to her figure and chilled her. Her shoes were covered with mud. A black-cowled monk approached with beads and breviary. Horror came into his countenance as he stumbled over the still warm bodies. He touched the girl in gentle pity, but he was jostled away rudely. He opened his book, and Sheila could see that he was pleading to be allowed to say a prayer over the bodies. A huge man struck him, and as he picked himself up, he silently cursed the murderers. He cursed them on the holy book, but they jeered in his face and continued their nefarious work. There, under the spreading chestnut tree, a pit was dug, and with neither prayer nor priest, into it the girl was flung. Then followed the other 23. The hole was small. The bodies protruded above the sides. With a ribald smile on his cruel face, the menacing figure in black forced the ground to receive them. The pit was covered in with earth. The murdered ones were safely hidden away, and Sheila realized she had witnessed a scene that had taken place some 300 years before, a scene that had been reenacted for her benefit. At last she knew what the eyes had tried to tell her. The figures died away, then seemed to be absorbed into the atmosphere itself, and once more only 23 pair of eyes were left, but they were eyes that looked at her with gratitude. They knew she understood. And as she watched them to fade away, she was conscious that her limbs were once more warm. She looked around in bewilderment. There on the bed lay the sleeping form of Duncan Kildrummy. She was back in his room. She felt her dress. It was quite dry. Her shoes had no trace of mud upon them. Lady Kildrummy entered. "My dear, I'm sorry," she said. "I'm afraid I have been rather a long time." "Why?" she broke off. "What's the matter?" For Sheila was gazing at the open door, and her expression was soft and pitiful. But Lady Kildrummy could not see the figure of a frail young girl dressed in a soft homespun with a white kerchief round her shoulders, a girl who looked at Sheila with thanks in her soft brown eyes. "I think I shall be able to help you lay your weird successfully, Lady Kildrummy," said Sheila. "I'll tell you later, after I've had time to think." Next day a small party gathered underneath the chestnut tree. The turf was smooth and velvety, had grown undisturbed for many centuries, but now was being removed. "Oh," said Sheila suddenly, for as she spade dug deep into the rich brown earth, a skeleton arm appeared. Reverently, the mold was removed. 22 skeletons were unearthed, 22 skeletons of full-grown men, but at the bottom of the pit was a tiny skeleton, a skeleton crushed and broken, and Sheila knew it was the last remains of the girl, the weird with the mournful eyes. Reverently, the bones were placed in an empty stone sarcophagus in the little chapel, and reverently, the minister spoke the prayers for the dead. And as the last amen was said, Sheila heard an unseen choir burst out in song. It was the Gloria in Excelsis Deo. Lady Kildrummy drew her cloak about her shoulders. "Do you hear the wind whistling?" she asked. Sheila smiled. She knew. 6 weeks later, Duncan Kildrummy was up for the first time after a serious attack of brain fever, during which for some days his life had been in the balance. But now the nervous twitchings were entirely gone, and his eye was clear and steady. "And you think we are free of the weird at last?" asked Lady Kildrummy, as she was bidding Sheila goodbye. "I hope so. I don't know the history of the turret room, but I should say that 23 were trapped there, and perhaps for religious reasons were foully murdered by some of your forebears. They were refused a Christian burial. That accounted for their hatred and their hauntings. The poor spirits were unable to rest in peace. Every 23 years, their number, they returned, but they could not make themselves understood." Stavridale accompanied Sheila to Glasgow. He was very silent during the journey, but as the train was drawing into the city, he suddenly took one of her hands. "Miss Carrar, Sheila, I won't
give all of this up," he urged. I can't, Mr. Hartland." "But why, Sheila? Won't you be my wife?" I can't explain, but I have a mission to fulfill. I've set myself a task, and I must complete it," she smiled at him. "Won't you wait a little?" "Then you do care," he said triumphantly, as he sought to draw her towards him. But the train had already stopped at the platform of the Glasgow terminus. Then all was bustle and rush. It was not until he had said goodbye to her, as she left for Edinburgh, where she had engaged rooms, that he realized she had not replied to his question. Well, perhaps the time was not yet ripe for his lovemaking, but he realized, whatever might befall, he had met his fate. And like a knight in the days of long ago, the wish of his lady was his law. He would bide her time, impatient though he might be.